Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Donald Reed, and this is the time set by the court for oral argument relating to the governor's request for an opinion of the justices concerning the constitutionality of certain legislation passed by the General Assembly. Before we begin, I would like to introduce my associate, Justin Mann. He is not on the papers because he first has to appear this afternoon before the court for another ceremony where hopefully he will be admitted to the bar, but he spent a lot of time on this and he deserves a lot of credit for it. At the request of the Chief Justice, my firm, Morris Nichols Arshton Tunnell, is presenting the position that the proposed amendments made by the legislation are unconstitutional. The proposed amendments at issue are essentially designed to restrict the prosecution of certain motor vehicle violations to lower courts where, under these amendments, the defendant will not have a right to a jury trial, where in most cases there will not be a lawyer-trained judge available, and again, in most cases, the defendant will not have a right of appeal. We respectfully submit that the proposed amendments, if signed into law, would be unconstitutional. I would first note that we agree with the Attorney General's office that the proposed amendments do not directly infringe on a right, either under the state or federal constitution, to a jury trial. As the court is aware, Article 3 jury trial provision in the U.S. Constitution does not apply to state court proceedings. The Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution only applies to serious offenses, which is defined as 6 months imprisonment or fine of $5,000 or more. So that is not implicated by the proposed amendments either. The Delaware Constitution also contains two jury trial provisions. The first, found in Article 1, Section 7, is not implemented by the proposed amendments because it has also been interpreted to apply only to serious offenses. Article 1, Section 4 provision, on the other hand, guarantees the right to a jury trial as it existed at common law, as imported from England in 1776. We spent a lot of time looking to try to find a statute or law from common law that was similar to the proposed amendments with the thought that they might have had a jury trial at that time. Despite all our research, we've concluded that there was no common law crimes like this that involved a right to a jury trial. So we believe that that provision is also not.
But there were traffic offenses, apparently.
There were, Your Honor. As we attached to our brief, we found a law from England, which in some respects is quite similar, dealing with ox carts and other things. But unfortunately, as we followed up on it, it appeared that there was no right to a jury trial for those offenses at common law either. So we do not believe that the jury trial provisions are implicated. On the other hand, we do submit that there are constitutional problems with the proposed amendments. Under the current law, a defendant charged with any of the offenses covered by the amendments would have a right to elect to have the case transferred to the Court of Common Pleas. As a result, under current law, a defendant is guaranteed a hearing before a law-trained judge in the Court of Common Pleas. The proposed amendments would eliminate that right of election for the covered offenses and would thereby effectively eliminate the right to have a law-trained judge hear the case. We submit that this would be a violation of the Due Process Clause. In the Shoemaker case, this court held that the Delaware court system, which was in place at the time of that decision, did not violate due process because, and I quote, "the Delaware system accords every defendant in a justice of the peace court the opportunity to be tried before a lawyer judge in the Court of Common Pleas." That's at 375 A. 2nd 439.
When you say law trained judge, do you mean someone who's been admitted to the bar, someone who has read the law, someone as it existed at least until the early 70s, who's been to an ABA-approved law school? What does that mean? Or is it learned in the law just being having some skill in the law?
Well, there are two answers to that, Your Honor. First, under Article 4, Section 2 of the Delaware Constitution, Court of Common Pleas judge must be, phrase is used, law-trained. But in addition, by statute, they must have been in the general practice of law for at least 5 years. So under current law, the Court of Common Pleas judges have to be lawyers in practice for at least 5 years.
By statute.
Well, let's think about an example where we have a current justice of the peace that went to a three-year law school and graduated, but never took the Delaware bar examination. One of your proposals is that a solution for the state would be to assign all of these matters to justices of the peace who are law trained. My question for you is, if you graduated from an ABA accredited law school, but never took a bar examination, would you be law trained?
I would have to say, Your Honor, that I think you would be law trained under those circumstances. You certainly would have gone through the training equivalent to being admitted to the bar, even though you apparently have not been actually taken the exam and been admitted. But I think under those circumstances, the person would be considered law trained, yes.
So it would be the equivalent of being a law school graduate.
I think that could be left to some extent to the General Assembly to define exactly what law trained means, but I think it would be reasonable to treat it that way, yes.
Well, the reason it's an issue that we need to focus on here is in view of your suggestion that an option is to assign these to law trained judges within the Justice of the Peace Court system. And we have to decide what law trained means. If it means being a law school graduate, and then there may be incumbent justices of the peace that would qualify.
Yes, I think that would be a reasonable approach, Your Honor.
Mr. Reed, from the briefs, I gleaned that there are two constitutional values that seem to be at stake here. One is the right to a trial by jury. The other is a right to have your case heard by a law-trained judge. Which of these is still on the table?
I think it's the second one, Your Honor.
We can eliminate trial by jury for purposes of this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think so.
All right. With respect to that, I understood, but maybe incorrectly, that your constitutional claim was not that the decriminalizing of these offenses would violate substantive due process, but only that it would create an invidious, some sort of invidious discrimination or discrimination procedurally that would violate the Equal Protection Clause. Is that the argument, or is it also a due process argument?
There's two arguments, Your Honor, and Your Honor started the question by saying there were two issues at this point, jury trial and due process. And actually, there were three originally, jury trial, due process, and equal protection. We have conceded essentially that the jury trial issue is not implicated by these amendments.
Well, the three you're referring to are doctrines of review or potential doctrines of invalidity. I was talking about values, and I thought the two values were right to a trial by jury and the right to have a law-trained judge hear your case.
We are.
And then the question is, which constitutional prohibition, if any, applies?
We are arguing two things, Your Honor, at this point. We have given up on the jury trial issue. We are arguing that there is a right to a law-trained judge, and that there also is a right to an appeal if there is a discrimination that's in violation of the Equal Protection.
Okay, and taking away the right to a law-trained judge in this category of cases that are covered by the amendment, are you claiming that that is both an equal protection and a due process violation, or solely an equal protection violation?
Actually, we're claiming that it's a due process violation.
Not right. Equal protection.
Correct.
Okay.
As I was saying, Your Honor, we believe that the Shoemaker case found that the system in place at the time did not violate the due process clause because every defendant had the right to elect to be tried before a law-trained judge.
Now, all of these cases, unlike these revised statutes, involve at least the threat of jail.
Well, Your Honor, that's the point I was going to turn to next.
Okay.
And I believe that's an appropriate question to raise. The court in Shoemaker found that there was no violation because there was this right to an election, and it then went on to say, well, can that right be waived? That was the next issue before the Shoemaker court. And if you look at the discussion by the Shoemaker court, it clearly looked at that waiver issue as a question of waiver of a constitutional right to trial by a lawyer judge. The court said, and again I quote, waiver of any constitutional right is not deemed to be a routine or casual occurrence in any of our courts, but it is not impossible, end of quote, and it can take place if there's a knowing waiver. The court then went on in Shoemaker to set out very specific standards and procedures for how the waiver should take place. And what's significant to Your Honor's question is that the court did not limit the discussion in Shoemaker to cases in which incarceration was the penalty. The court expressly stated that specific procedures were also required to be followed when there was a waiver of the election right where, and I quote, prison sentence is not authorized by law. That's at 375 A. Second, 443. It set up a slightly less stringent procedure for cases where you were not going to be incarcerated, but it again set up a procedure requiring that had to be followed before there could be a waiver of this constitutional right. And I would note that the court expressly pointed out in Shoemaker that motor vehicle violations covered by Title 21 were included within the offenses in the JP court's jurisdiction, which it had in mind in that case.
Now, at this point, are we talking about a federal or state constitutional right or both?
It's unclear, Your Honor. The Shoemaker certainly started from the proposition that it was looking at what happened in the North case, which was a federal constitutional decision. And it, the initial part of the decision talked about we meet the standards set by North in, under Delaware law. It's unclear whether the court was extending anything beyond what was required by the federal constitution or not.
Well, what is your position?
There is no specific, we have not been able to find any specific cases under federal law dealing with this issue where you do not face incarceration, there's only a fine imposed, and whether you have a constitutional right to a law-trained judge.
I thought that you were relying on the Third Circuit case in Lacates in part for that proposition, and as you recall in Lacates, it was a civil debt action, and what the court said a couple of things in Lacates. One was that you had a right to a jury trial at common law, so you had a right to a jury trial in that case. But the second thing they talked about was the law-trained judge. And while the Third Circuit talked about the Delaware Constitution, there's a sentence in there that says, and general due process principles require you to have a right to appear before a law-trained judge at some point in the process, which would mean you could stay in the Justice of the Peace Court by election and waiver as long as you were afforded the right to appear before a law-trained judge if you wanted to. So I had the impression you were relying on Lacates for that proposition that you had a right to a law-trained judge in a civil proceeding.
You're correct, Your Honor. And again, Lacates obviously is a Third Circuit case, but it was unclear to me whether, in fact, they were relying solely on Delaware constitutional law or federal law.
Well, that's why what it says here is, the preceding discussion demonstrates that in Delaware, by virtue of the state constitution and general due process principles, so they said both, the Delaware constitution and general due process principles, then they go on to talk about the law-trained judge, and then the subsequent discussion cites federal cases. So I understood that sentence to be that it was an alternative holding.
I would agree with you, Your Honor. I believe that they did try to tie the discussion into federal constitutional principles as well.
Mr. Reed, just to further explore your equal protection claim, let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's assume that in year one, the General Assembly enacts the statutory scheme that was in existence immediately before these amendments. Under that scheme, if your case originated in the Alderman's Court, you had the right to appeal to a law-trained judge, correct?
Yes.
And that was also true if your case originated in JP Court, then you could go to the Court of Common Pleas.
Yes.
Assume that in year two, the legislature decides to rescind, well, decides to adopt the precise amendments that were adopted here, which results in taking away one of those rights of appeal. That is from the JP to the Common Pleas Court. So all I'm doing is taking the facts as they exist in this case, but compressing them into a two-year period. Okay. My question is, is the legislature barred by some principle of equal protection from taking away in year two what it granted in year one?
If I understood your hypothetical correctly, Your Honor, it's our position that the General Assembly cannot, under equal protection theory, they cannot have a system where you have the same offense in two similar courts and grant a right of appeal in one and not the other.
Then are you arguing that while the General Assembly can create the right to appeal to a law-trained judge, as was the case before the amendments, it can't take that right away?
It absolutely can take the right away if it takes the right away for all people who are similarly situated. The problem is when
it can't just reverse what it did without reversing the other half of the machine, right?
Correct. We believe it has to treat it equally.
I'd like to ask you about extraordinary writs and what role, if any, that they may have in this analysis. First of all, the Superior Court can issue a writ of certiorari this court can issue some extraordinary writs as well. And they would be issued by law-trained judges to bring up the record and review at least part of the proceedings below, the face of the proceedings below. Does that satisfy the, assuming there's a constitutional requirement of a law-trained judge, does that satisfy that requirement, having some availability of review by extraordinary writ?
I'm just trying to understand Your Honor's question. So if we assume that the proposed amendments go into place...
Well, Shoemaker itself was a certiorari case.
It was, Your Honor.
So there was review in Shoemaker by this court, which had law-trained judges. And basically requirements were set forth by the court for future proceedings and in that proceeding. Does that satisfy, assuming that LaCapes was correctly decided, does that satisfy the right of review by a law-trained judge?
Your Honor, the problem I'm having is that under the system at the time of the Shoemaker, you had a right to elect to a law-trained judge, so it was already in place. So this would just be icing on the cake. It would not add anything.
Let me try to question a different way. As I understand it, there's no right of appeal under the proposed statute, but the right of petition for certiorari would still exist. The question would be, if you can file a petition for certiorari with a law-trained judge, is that enough access to a law-trained judge through certiorari that you can eliminate the right of appeal?
Your Honor, I would submit that it is not, because the writ of certiorari is an extraordinary writ. It's an unusual situation. It would not be available in every case, and therefore it would not be sufficient to satisfy the demands of due process.
So your position would be that the due process right is a right to the opportunity to have your case heard initially on the merits by a law-trained judge, rather than reviewed in a limited way later by certiorari?
Now, I have to concede that under a number of the cases, I believe that if the system was such that you had the right to have review by a law-trained judge, even if it wasn't in the initial decision-making process, that would be sufficient. but it has to be available in every case.
Right. So that's the language in the Third Circuit case that says at some point during the process of adjudication.
Yes, Your Honor.
So certiorari wouldn't work because actually it's discretionary review.
Correct, Your Honor.
To put it a different way, certiorari was not the functional equivalent of an appeal.
Absolutely right, Your Honor. Turning back to the our position, we believe, as discussed, that in addition to the due process issue, we have there is a problem with the proposed amendments in that they create a situation where the defendant's right of appeal is determined solely by whether he was convicted in a JP court on the one hand or a mayor's or alderman's court on the other hand. As stated in our briefs, we acknowledge that there is no constitutional right to an appellate review in every case. The General Assembly does not have to provide that for every type of offense, but when it is available for a certain offense, it must be equally available to all convicted of that offense. The Attorney General's Office argues that there are significant historical differences between the courts which would justify the different treatment on appeal. But as noted in its brief, the Attorney General's brief, most of those differences have been eliminated. And under the current system, we submit that there are not sufficient differences between the courts to justify the different appellate rights. For all those reasons, therefore, we respectfully submit that the justices should conclude that the proposed amendments, if signed into law, would be unconstitutional. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the Office of the Attorney General for the purpose of arguing the constitutionality of the legislation that has been passed. First, thank you for the opportunity to address this. It's an unusual circumstance for me not to be able to lose somebody's conviction. It's actually a little more comfortable. And it's been a pleasure dealing with appointed counsel. I can tell you that we work well together, and when we discussed some of these issues, we came at it separately, spoke shortly before we filed our opening brief, and found that we really had identified the same constitutional issues, and that was gratifying to know. I have to say that in our office, we said that they out-Justice Holland us when they found the statutes relating from 1773. We were just sticking with a law review article that said that traffic on the highway at common law, they found the actual ones and did the side-by-side comparison, and who would have known that they had reckless driving of ox carts back then, but they did. We both agree, and I think that it's relatively clear, that there is no right to a jury trial in offenses such as this. While this court has never specifically said that under the Delaware State Constitution, there is the state petty offense doctrine, certainly the cases have made it clear. I think Thomas and Clements have most specifically said that, although in a little different context, in the criminal contempt context. But when you lay that out, look at the state constitutional provisions, I believe that that becomes clear. So we've moved to really what I believe is probably the most difficult of the issues in here, and that is because our research tells us the same thing. We could not find really a federal case that tells us what is the dividing line to the due process question. When do you have a right to a law-trained judge, and when may a matter perhaps be adjudicated without it? But what we did find is in each and every case where a court had dealt with it, it always made it clear that it was that threat of incarceration which seemed to trigger the need for a law-trained judge. And there is that second question, that is the definitional question of what is a law-trained judge. Our justices of the peace are far different than they were when the Third Circuit looked at them in Lecates. That's 31 years ago, almost now. About that same time, I believe, is when the chief magistrate's position was made such that it had to be someone who is a graduate and member of the bar to be the chief magistrate.
Help me understand, Mr. Wallace, if there are any limits on just simply a financial judgment before someone who is not law trained and no right of review. Could the General Assembly confer jurisdiction on someone who is not a law trained judge to award $1 million and have no review by a law trained judge?
I suggest that civil penalty perhaps is so great that you would get into Lacate's type circumstance, or Clawins, or the other North versus Russell, which the latter are criminal. Lacate's dealt with a civil matter. I believe that you do. There is some dividing line in the civil context. $1 million certainly seems like it would be one where you would have to have a certain level of review available by a law-trained judge. But that's not the case with these. What we're talking about are fines of $95 or less.
If we're asked to define when that there's no right here because, is it just because of the dollar amounts are so low and we just don't reach the question of when it crosses the line?
I believe you can. And I believe the court can, because I believe that what Article 4, Section 28 tells us, if we're looking at the Federal Due Process Clause, nobody has made it clear that for such a low offense, you have to have a law-trained judge. I think the closest is the language that Justice Holland read, and that was in the civil context, and even that wasn't really speaking to it. But what we know is that from Article 4, Section 28, we have ingrained in our, or put into the Delaware State Constitution, that there is a dividing line between offenses and how they may be treated, both on appeal and perhaps as to this, quote, right to a law-trained judge, that a fine less than $100 may be won, because Article 4, Section 28 doesn't just say that's where you can appeal, but it also says in empowering inferior courts, it tells whether or not they need to be indicted. It tells whether or not they need a jury trial. And I suggest that inherent in that is also the nature of the judicial officer to hear it. Also, if we are going to take it from the history of, in fact, the judiciary and who handled these offenses, certainly at common law, I thank our co-counsel, because what they have done is showed us a broad history of mayor's courts, aldermen's courts, non-law trained judge courts. And what is clear is they were much more common in common law than they are now. And in fact, who was hearing those reckless driving by an ox cart? Non-law trained judges. So why would we believe that doesn't come through?
We have to look at due process today, at least under the federal constitution. I mean, we all agree there weren't law schools back in Blackstone's time, and people studied for the law, and you got called to the bar a different way. But what the federal cases seem to suggest is that due process has evolved over time, and an element of due process now includes an adjudication by a law-trained judge. And the question for us is, as you've identified, what's the threshold?
We would suggest respectfully that one should be jail, that the threat of jail, because each case seems, in the criminal context, seems to always mention one should not be incarcerated or have the threat of incarceration without the potential of a law-trained judge.
Yeah, and probably everyone would, you might reach a consensus on that. But let's go back to Lacate, which was simply a civil case, and there they said at some time in the process you were entitled, as a matter of due process, to a law-trained judge. Now, we know the amount in controversy there was much higher than the amounts in this statute. But going back to Justice Ridgely's question, if we're going to use the amount in controversy as the barometer, how do we determine the threshold where you get a law-trained judge and you don't?
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that perhaps if you use that same sliding scale of the financial means, then you use the same scale as to what is law-trained for the purposes of hearing that type of matter. As I said, the justice of the peace in Delaware sitting now is far different than the justice of the peace really even 30 years ago. As I mentioned, first of all, the chief magistrate must be. You've
mixed two things together, and it's fine. But, you know, for purposes of understanding the argument, I think they're separate. One question would be, do you get a law-trained judge? And then we have to identify the threshold. Your answer now seems to be suggesting you are getting a law-trained judge in the justice of the peace because the training of justices of the peace are a lot different. So I think those are two separate arguments. Do you have a law-trained judge? And what's the threshold if you don't? And your answer now seems to be suggesting we don't really need to get to the threshold because we have law-trained judges, even if they're not law school graduates.
I guess my first answer would be, Your Honor, if there is a threshold, then I think we use Article 4, Section 28 and the $100 threshold. Secondly, that perhaps we need not get to that because if we use the definitional term of law-trained judge, it is not defined statutorily. It's really not defined in the case law anywhere. And in fact, as Your Honor pointed out, I'm pretty sure, as I had asked the chief magistrate, actually, in preparing for this, we have 60 justices of the peace. I believe about 10% of them would be considered, quote, law-trained, have gone to law school. But all of them follow basically the administrative directive of the Justice of the Peace Court under Rule 108, which gives them basic legal education, ensures that they have to have 30 hours of continuing legal education every 2 years. That's actually more than lawyers have to have, whether they are a lawyer, members of the bar or not. So there is a much different type of justice of the peace sitting now than perhaps in Lacate's. And if we try to use the definition of law trained, again, maybe there is that sliding scale. That is proper training when you're talking about this type of offense. It's a rather simple matter as opposed to, for instance, maybe a UCC matter or something like that.
Well, we don't need to get into the thicket of whether or not or what constitutes a law-trained judge unless we first decide that a due process right attaches. And on that issue, I think your position, at least part of it, is very clear. If there's no risk of incarceration, the possibility of incarceration, then there's no due process right.
Yes.
The problem comes into play where you have, where you consider in addition to or apart from incarceration a fine. I understand that the Delaware Constitution draws that line at $100. Justice Holland's questions, however, suggest that the rule may be different. If we're considering that same question from the standpoint of the federal constitution. So my question is are you aware of any principled basis for deciding what amount of fine would trigger or wouldn't trigger, a due process right to a law-trained judge?
I am not, Your Honor, and I'd suggest that under the federal constitution, as best as I can tell, as best as our research can tell us, is there would be no financial trigger, that it would be only incarceration, because that's the only thing that really seemed to trigger it, for instance, in North versus Russell.
Well, let's suppose that the Delaware General Assembly established, for a routine traffic violation, a minimum $1,000 or $1,500 fine, but no incarceration. You're saying that wouldn't trigger a due process right?
A federal due process right? That line, I simply cannot find in current federal law, Your Honor. That's the best I can give you the answer. As many cases as we looked, whenever we looked, incarceration always seemed to be the trigger, so they never had to talk about the financial aspect of it. And that's why I feel fairly comfortable saying that for the federal due process claim clause, it appears that the threat of incarceration is that which triggers the need for a law-trained judge, whatever it
might be. I was arguing that in Shoemaker, this court talked about motor vehicle violations and seemed to suggest that incarceration wasn't the deciding factor. Do you have a different view of Shoemaker?
Well, I think I do have a slightly different view on Shoemaker, because you have to look at it in the context of what was being discussed in Shoemaker. This court held that, in fact, for a person to stay within the jurisdiction of the Justice of the Peace Court, they had to basically knowingly waive their right. But they were not just waiving some constitutional right. They were waiving important statutory rights. And so this court said that to knowingly do that, you have to waive it. It never paid attention necessarily, I'd suggest, to the incarceration, non-incarceration. What it was looking at was focusing on this person has a statutory right to have review or to go to the Court of Common Pleas. He or she must know that they have that before, in fact, the Justice of the Peace may exercise jurisdiction. So it did not, there was no need to make that. And I don't think that you can read more than that into Shoemaker. As to the equal protection issue that related to the fact that under the proposed statute,
Mr. Wallace, before you get to that, and the case, as far as whether there's a federal constitutional right to a law-trained judge, that's the highest authority that speaks to it that you're aware of?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the highest authority we could find. And really the closest, I believe, Lacates comes to saying that there is a federal constitutional due process right is the language that Justice Holland mentioned. And I don't even know that that's necessarily a clear dictate.
Well, help us out, though, following up on Justice Ridgely's question. You know, the governor's asking for the opinion of the five of us individually, and, yeah, and we're going to try to reach a consensus, and normally we can give him one answer. But the governor is basically saying, is this going to be fine? What do we say about Lacates, where you have a sentence that says, general due process requires a law-trained judge at some point in the proceeding? Do we say, we don't think Lacates is still good law? Or do we say, what do we say about Lacates when we're trying to answer the governor's question?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to look at the fact that Lacates was a very different type of offense. Due process is different. Due process depends on the nature of the action itself. And so perhaps because what we were actually talking about was the actual taking of someone's property, you may have a different source of due process required for that. It wasn't a criminal case. It wasn't basically what it was, a simple motor vehicle case where somebody could only get a $95 fine. So it's decided in a different context, and therefore due process, the requirements of due process for that type of situation may indeed be very different.
Well, the phraseology that the Third Circuit adopted in Lacates was rather odd. The court did not say federal due process. It used the term general due process.
And they seem to be doing much more an attempt of this Article 1, Section 9 than any federal due process claim, and they spent quite a bit of time on that. And we'd suggest we're somewhat off in what Article 1, Section 9 truly requires.
Help me understand why there's more significance to a lawyer-trained judge option than there is to a jury trial. Why can't we just say $5,000, like a jury trial? And as I understand the federal law, you don't have a right to a jury trial if you're subject to a fine less than $5,000.
That's
true.
What's
the principal distinction between jury trial and lawyer-trained judge, however that's defined?
I don't. That's why I go back to Article 4, Section 28, Your Honor, because I think that if, like I said, this court has never said, under the state constitution, this is our petty offense doctrine, because certainly the state constitution can grant greater rights to a right to a jury trial and other rights than the federal constitution does. By practice, what that has ended up meaning is, for instance, the jury trial right, the ability to go to transfer to a court or to be heard in a court de novo and have a jury hear it, has always been 30 days and $100. So to my mind, I always think, well, that is the state petty offense level, even though we could go further if we wished.
Well, no,
and that's why I dropped back to the
$9. And I understand that. But if we're groping for what constitutes this amorphous general due process, or we're trying to distinguish between federal due process or some enhanced state due process right, why don't we just take the $5,000 as a logical response to whatever general due process would say to a right to a lawyer-trained judge, just as we do for taking the word of the United States Supreme Court for federal due process in a jury trial?
I think the court could certainly do that, that if there is a federal due process trigger, that it is any threat of incarceration and a fine of greater than $5,000, because it would be similar to the federal petty offense doctrine. And I believe that people would have understood that petty offenses such as those at common law would have been adjudicated by, quote, non-law trained judges. And
well,
we're further down
the line. I asked you about the case. Maybe they provided support for your answer. At the end of the opinion, it says, in the situation here with the constitutional interest of the indigent sued before a justice of the peace is so fundamental, then they go on to say what due process requires. So your focus on the minimum nature of the fines here would be basically to say it doesn't invoke a fundamental right.
It doesn't invoke the fundamental right that the actual taking of property did in that particular case, but from an indigent, as opposed to a regulatory offense in which you may be fined. I suggest that there may be different due process requirements there.
So your position would be that Locate stands for the proposition that you have a right to a law-trained judge at some point in the adjudicatory process if a fundamental right is at stake, for example, loss of liberty.
Yes.
Or loss of money exceeding a certain level.
Yes, I believe that's a...
But your position is that what's at stake here is not a fundamental right. Therefore, the equal protection level of scrutiny would be rational basis, and there is a rational basis for the distinctions that are made here between the Alderman's Court and the JP Court. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor. Because there is no fundamental right to a jury trial in offenses of this level, and there is no fundamental right to an appeal period, then all you need is a rational basis. And as we set forth in our briefing, I think there is a rational basis in why someone who is convicted before an alderman, and under this, they would have to go to the alderman first. They can't transfer out. So their matter has to be heard by the alderman, that they may seek relief in the state court system. And it's not just the law-trained judge part of it, but the state court system overall, which this court sits as the administrative head, the Chief Justice does, and can ensure, for instance, the policies and procedures of the Justice of the Peace Court, the criminal procedure law rules that are set forth. And because of that historical nature of the difference between an alderman and what we now know is the modern state court Justice of the Peace system, that there is a rational basis for the General Assembly to say, anybody who has to stay in the alderman court first, we want them to have some relief in the state court system if, in fact, they get a certain
because
funds.
The quality of the adjudication in the JP court, at least as a result of the changes that have taken place in the last couple of decades, is higher than in the alderman's court?
Yes. And this court, for instance, as the administrator, as I noted, doesn't have the same power to ensure the quality and state law doesn't provide for the qualifications and everything else. Look, it's very clear in the articles that both sides have put in and the discussions of the Alderman Court Committee that there's always been some disquiet with the Alderman Court system throughout the country.
To be consistent with your earlier answer, if we're going to move away from deciding what it means to be a law-trained judge, you basically would have to say the state's done this and there's a rational basis for doing it, but it didn't have to do it because there was no fundamental right at stake.
Yes. Certainly statutes can grant greater rights and greater protections, and that's what the General Assembly decided to do.
One last question, and it's the same one that I asked Mr. Reed. Let's assume hypothetically that in year one, the General Assembly enacts the statutory scheme that it existed immediately before the amendments that we're dealing with now. And then 12 months later, in year two, it undoes part of that scheme by enacting the amendments at issue here. Given that small space of time within, assuming there are no intervening material developments, can the legislature do that without any risk of constitutional violations?
Absolutely. I certainly don't believe that that brings to bear any equal protection problem. And in fact, the General Assembly has done that in the past. If you look at...
Well, what the legislature giveth, it can taketh away?
As long as it's within the bounds of the Constitution, yes.
Well, that's the issue. Well, that is that the Mr. Reed says once you create... in both courts, the Alderman's Court and the JP Court, the right to appeal to law-trained judges. You can't take that right away from litigants in one court and leave that right in the other.
Well, I'd suggest respectfully that Article 4, Section 28 then becomes a nullity because the General Assembly can't act under it. It can only go one way, apparently. One, it hasn't historically done that, as we set forth in our brief, as it has adjusted, for instance, the appellate statutes. And two, it need not do it, as long as it remains within Article 4, Section 28. And I think there's always the presumption that the General Assembly is reacting to the requirements of the courts. For instance, that's why we're here, to try to alleviate some of the clogging of courts. And that's the things they take into consideration.
Well, if you're correct that, you know, assuming no material intervening events between the first enactment and then the amendment, then there should be no equal protection issue at all.
Yes. There's nothing further from the court.
I would have a question. In terms of the process for appointment of aldermen today, when it goes to the governor, he gets a list to choose that the mayor has submitted. Is that how it works?
I don't even know if it's a list, Your Honor. I think it's one name. I think generally the either the city council or the mayor picks one person and says, this is the person we would like to have appointed, and then the governor. It's unclear to me. I'm not quite sure about that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
No, I have nothing to add.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your assistance, and particularly Mr. Reed, you, your colleague, and your firm for your pro bono effort on behalf of the court. Thank you all very much. We'll be taking this under advisement and recessing.
Aye.